Hello and welcome to the Data Development Podcast from Venturi's Voice. I'm your host, Andy Davis. In this show, I'll be chatting to data experts from all sectors about their careers in tech. The show aims to bring you insights, anecdotes and stories from like-minded professionals that you can learn from and apply to your own career. If you like the show and you want to hear more from us, you can follow us via SoundCloud, iTunes or Spotify, or you can join us on Slack. Thank you and enjoy the show. We have Mattia Fiorentini here from Cambridge Quantum Computing, and he's the head of machine learning and quantum algorithms over there. So I'm very much looking forward to this discussion. I'm going to hope that I can keep up, but we'll soon find out. So thanks very much, Mattia.
Well, thank you, Andy, for having me here. It's really a pleasure.
Yeah, it should be fun conversation. I mean, I find it fascinating, and you are almost in some respects with the kind of the PhD under the belt. I think what people would expect from someone working in something like machine learning. But I just wonder actually whether that is actually the kind of traditional path to a lot of the people who you now work with at Cambridge Quantum Computing. Do a lot of people kind of pursue that academia route and pursue their PhD?
In my organization specifically, let's say that half probably of the people I work with have a PhD or at least some research experience in academia. Mm-hmm. I think this is quite a useful background when it comes to working up in a tech startup, which is still very much R&D focused. When it comes to, generally speaking, data science, I think that still the number of PhD is possibly quite high, especially compared to other technical fields. Mm-hmm. And I believe that the reason for that is that it's still relatively, the knowledge you have to be a successful data scientist is kind of quite wide, and in spite of some courses being offered by university or even these massive online open courses, there is no formal education that really it's able to kickstart specifically your career as a data scientist.
Do you think that it's a weird one, isn't it? Because it's counterintuitive in a lot of ways. I think a lot of software developers, for instance, are almost avoiding like a traditional way and a traditional route into a technical career. I don't know, perhaps because, you know, it's difficult for an institution to, I suppose, keep up with, something like technology that changes so frequently. So, yeah, it's an interesting one that, you know, like you mentioned, in your field, there just seems to be a lot of people who stay in academia for a long time. Is there not, I suppose, I clearly don't have a PhD myself, but is it a different process when you're in working under a PhD as opposed to perhaps an undergrad where it's a bit more of a strict curriculum, whereas in PhD, do you get more exposure to various technologies? Are they able to kind of keep up with, you know, the rapid pace of change? Because that, I suppose, for me, that's always going to be a concern and a difficulty that, you know, something like a educational institution will have.
Andy, yeah, I think that the point you're making is a good point. Clearly, in the data science field, many of the techniques and the tools are still rapidly evolving and changing. And definitely one of the qualities of a successful researcher or a successful PhD is the one of being a sort of learning machine, which means getting ideas and suggestion and topic and project being thrown at you, and being able to quickly go from idea to prototyping to something that looks like, let's say, a product or a system that has some sort of outcome that is very viable and gets you somewhere. So I guess that this is quite a unique, useful experience that somebody who has spent some time to doing research in academia has opposed to somebody that maybe have a very good formal education with a bachelor or a master and hasn't had the chance of really getting his or her hands dirty and really owning some piece of work.
So I suppose that is the kind of the differences, and I suppose, you know, what are the, you know, the real substance do you feel is so enabling when you start to actually go into industry from academia? What do you think that, you know, the, when you look back and you think that was the real value in that, you know, what there may be a multiple, but what areas do you typically believe are the biggest enablers to allow you to do your job well now in industry?
I guess this depends, generally speaking, from the sector. Of course, I can only speak about my field of data science and machine learning. I guess that especially when working into startup, it's really key to be a sort of self-starter. This is something that it's a quality that usually you develop through your PhD, where you spend a lot of time alone with little to no supervision and have to come up with the right idea and then turn the right idea into some substance, into a piece of code or a piece of research that you can discuss and can withstand some form of scrutiny by your peer or your superior. I think that this is something that I found very useful and very important for the success in the data science of a data scientist, especially for senior role, where you are supposed to demonstrate what's it called technical leadership. So not only to be able to execute instruction, high level, let's say, instruction and turn it into action, into code, into actionable insight, if you speak about data science, but also to effectively show leadership in making suggestions what should be done, what would be interesting to do for the whole business, and being confident that you are able to turn this idea into action and into some form of useful outcome.
So, you know, your background in general, you know, obviously working, I want to, I suppose, cover the actual academia and the background that you had. So will you just tell us a little bit about, like, you know, what your kind of background was, how you, I suppose, yeah, the journey that you've been on to get to where you are now?
Absolutely. I would be very happy to share this. So I studied physics for all the time that I spent in education in academia. So I started with a bachelor in Milan in general physics. Then I moved a little bit more to condensed matter and theoretical physics during my master. I spent some good time at the International Center for Theoretical Physics in Trieste. And that was the first chance that I had to feel how research worked, really. That was for my master thesis. After that, I made my choice and I decided to try the academic career, the research career. And so that naturally resulted in accepting a PhD offer from King's College London. Mm-hmm. The subject was computational physics, which is a subject of physics where you try to take very complex theory and solve them for real case scenario by exploiting high performance computing. Mm-hmm. The PhD, I guess, was really a challenging moment, both because, of course, the expectation from your supervisor, from your peer, also from myself, was quite high in terms of doing science, really, and try to, no matter how small my contribution was, to get something authentic that could advance the overall scientific knowledge. And also from a personal level, because you, during the PhD, you learn how to deal with failure, learn how to deal with things that sometimes look bigger than you. And yeah, that was, I think, very instructive experience, quite tough, I have to admit. And probably also because I'm quite proud of my background as a scientist, but I have to admit probably there is a small part of me which makes me also a little engineer. I decided that I wanted to use the wealth of knowledge that I acquired throughout almost 9 years of academic study and academic research and try to turn it into something that maybe resembled more than a product rather than a paper or some piece of shareable knowledge.
Interesting. Really interesting. Did you find that, your colleagues during your PhD kind of fell into a similar paths, or was it all relatively quite different?
I guess that in spite of maybe studying different topics and somebody, doing physical experiments in the lab, somebody else doing mostly pen and paper calculation, I think we all shared to a good extent the same feeling of challenge, of really trying to give our best to academia, really, and to the scientific community. That was really a shared feeling and really a common topic of discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So the difficulties that one can find while trying to do this.
Yeah, interesting. So obviously, moving kind of forward, I suppose, on the timeline and into some of your kind of R&D work, I think, obviously the research must be fascinating at PhD level, but then when it comes to, you find yourself in a situation where we're looking at, things like machine learning and artificial intelligence, and, they're some of the hottest topics in tech at the moment, if not the hottest topics in tech. I suppose, first of all, it's a really difficult one to kind of niche down and dissect. So explain it to me how you kind of see it, the technical side. Do you see it as like this is the solution, or is it more of like an enabler to help solve like problems? What's your kind of approach? Is it the problem first or the tech first?
That's a very interesting question, and I suppose this is going to resonate with perhaps some of our audience here. It would be interesting to us to know, what's in our audience as well, could be the feeling, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you probably ask somebody who comes from more from a business perspective, they will probably praise AI and let's use the term machine learning, which is something I'm more comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
How that can enable new business opportunity or help some products to scale. Generally speaking, they will see how with using machine learning you can automate a lot of topics and make them tasks. Or maybe relieve the burden of manual or repetitive tasks from human or individuals, maybe from human employee to, let's say, robot or a robot employee to some extent. On the other hand, the technical people will probably focus more on the development aspect of machine learning and AI. And what is yet to be done in order for this technology to fully deliver its potential in terms, for example, of safe and reliable self-driving car or in automated, again, reliable and safe, safety is a big concern for some here. Medical diagnosis, that's definitely another topic. Yeah, I guess that there is no, both of these points of view are valid and really, really important.
Mm-hmm.
From my point of view, I suppose that for the state in which machine learning is as of today, it's a great enabling technology, but but it has to be regarded as a technique, or again, I think that the term you use as enabling technology is very appropriate here.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be packaged up with some other layer or more simple technology to then deliver a product or a service, something that be then sold to a retail customer or business-to-business market. So yeah, that's my view.
How do you depict, I mean, I suppose now you're in industry, is there a difference between depicting like what you focus your attention on? Like, you know, it's difficult to say like what the bigger problem is at times, you know, but... you know, I suppose in PhD, you're probably trying to solve a different problem than you do in industry. I suppose it's more probably from a client basis, they want you to try and solve a problem for them, you know, using the technology that you have.
Yeah.
So, you know, how, you know, the problems that you're dealing with, I suppose, is what I'm curious about. Is it like, what is the scale of these problems? Are they typically big problems? As far as like what the outcome is going to change, you know, do you ever feel, I suppose, underwhelmed by a problem that you're trying to solve with something like, you know, AI or machine learning?
Yeah, sure. So let me start by saying that clearly there are, what I'm doing now as opposed to what I was doing when I was a researcher is quite different. Say that when I was a researcher, I was doing purely scientific research. While here, it's more trying to fix problems / trying to do some engineering. So, freezing some performance indicator of a system that are already in production, or perhaps creating new system from scratch, but always with this idea of a product, of a service, and of a user in mind. I guess that's really key in tech, to have the user and to be product-centric and customer-centric. It's the philosophy that I think made Amazon such a great company.
Mm-hmm.
But to answer your other question about the scale of the problem we deal with, so the specific subfield of machine learning that I deal with in my team is deep learning, which is the utilization of neural network. And particularly, I apply this to time series forecasting and financial time series. So in machine learning, generally speaking, the scale and the size of the problem, both from a conceptual point of view and from a point of view of the infrastructure needed for supporting the data, it can be daunting because for example, we know that financial data, it's on the terabyte scales. There are possibly, I think, close to the, you know, tens of millions of transactions, even any financial product that is traded at a major exchange for per day. Mm-hmm. If you think that about, you know, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of financial products scattered around, again, hundreds of exchange all over the world, you can see the scale of the problem there. I guess that from the point of view of size of the problem conceptually, so conceptually in a specific case on applying machine learning to finance, clearly, you know, the task, it's very, very difficult. That's why myself and so many of my colleagues have a PhD, because the art of some of the tricks that you learn while doing the PhD is to be able to decompose a big problem, smaller problem, and proceed step by step.
Mm-hmm.
Start with something that in a business term is called a minimum viable product, and then mm-hmm. expand from that. That's really something that has to be kept in mind.
Yeah.
For the data side, that requires clearly some very focused technical skill, but luckily enough, when it comes to purely data management and data engineering, let's say the people with a good software engineering background are equipped with all the tools to deal with this. And you know, in the past few years, there are so many provider of big data services and cloud services that such as Amazon, AWS, Google Cloud Platform, Microsoft Azure, that really help. Actually, they I think that they are almost necessary. That they have this service provider technology that any person dealing with big data has to be reckoned with.
You mentioned in your notes, obviously before the podcast, about the first AI revolution. I think you said 2012 until now. And I suppose we pondered the question about, you know, what could drive the next one. And I think you're alluding to, you know, quantum computers. So, you know, are we there? You know, I suppose. Are we currently going through the process? And what, you know, to a lot of people, they're still under the assumption that, you know, we are in the process of AI, because, you know, I know that AI in confined environments is valuable, but we've not got AI simply for the masses just yet. But you're hinting that there's already another revolution underway via quantum computers. Can you just kind of dissect that statement a little bit for us and kind of perhaps go into a bit more detail on what is, I suppose, actually meant by that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, so by the first AI revolution, it is a term that is probably a bit more kind of catchy or buzzword-like.
But right.
If you think about, you know, some may recall that before 2011, nobody was talking about AI, apart from people reading Asimov, probably. Or nobody was really aware or ever heard, or nobody had ever heard the term machine learning. And that was because that topic was confined really only to the computer science department of university and academia. Then people like Andrew and G managed to show how uniting big data, the new computer capabilities provided by graphical processing unit, plus some refinement of algorithms that have been studied for decades, such as neural networks, could be used to solve something that almost looked like a business problem. In that case was, if I remember, collective learning to detect if in a picture there was a cat or not. Again, this looks like more of a proof of principle, but once that was done, many people, especially in academia, immediately realized the sudden change or the sudden proof of maturity that machine learning has reached at that point. From that point onward, especially with the advancement in computer vision, and you know, it's machine learning and especially the neural network became mainstream and became very fashionable to talk about it in business and try to apply it. Many startups have been created, and so on and so forth. But which the enabler of this kind of AI revolution, if you want to use this if you want to say it in a layman term, were abundance of data, very powerful hardware, right, and then the ability of coding this very powerful algorithm on the hardware and connected to the data, really. This wave of machine learning algorithms are mainly characterized and goes by the name of supervised learning algorithms, which do great things for us, but they are not really capable of any thinking. They're very good at making a straightforward process for human automatic, And what I mean by that is that, again, this is quoting Andrew and Jay, that anything that should take a human being, something like a second or so of thinking, can be straightforwardly automated by using this technology. And by automated, I know the, I mean that we can go from, 1 second per operation or 2 seconds per operation from, 1 millisecond. So, you have a 3 or 4 order of magnitude of increasing efficiency. The experts in the field really think that it's missing here is, again, the reasoning part. And to be able to come up with interesting question and be, I think that reasoning is really about being able to figure out which information you need to understand the topic and then go and get it, which if you think about it, it's extraordinary. This is what the human brain is excellent at. When it's faced with a problem, despite having little to no information about it, it can figure out what information it may need. So the question to answer, that should be answered first, and then find the answer. This is incredible, astonishing. No computer, no machine, as of today, is able to do now. The most promising way here, it's a branch of machine learning called reinforcement learning, but it's still something very experimental, and it's severely limited, I guess, by the time that it's needed for this algorithm to actually learn something useful and the amount of data they have to be exposed to. So that's why I think, this was a very lengthy introduction about what enabled the current state of machine learning and what the current state of machine learning is all about. What's next to come? Again, mm-hmm. the next thing to come is what is called general artificial intelligence and the ability for this machine to reason and nobody knows exactly where the next enabling factor will come from. People like me and or people that work in the quantum computing industry, of course, are argue or try to think and try to solve this issue with their own mean and their own technique. And it has been proven that quantum computing could be a way and a technique to really unlock immense computing capability. Mm. Although this we haven't found a way yet to make this happen. And this is probably 10 to 15 years away. But this is, my point is that we, as the pioneer of machine learning and deep learning and AI, waited from the 60s and the 70s until basically 5-6 years ago to look their creation, their invention, become real in a way and contaminate and change the way business done and tech business is done. Why don't give this quantum computing and this technology 10, 15 years and let it make its case on how it could help to enable the next wave of reasoning machine.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. That'll be reasoning and then meaning next after that, and then we're officially being taken over, right?
Yes, perhaps, or maybe we will be very well taken care of.
Yeah, that's a good way. That's an optimistic way to look at things, certainly. I don't want to keep it for too much longer. I know we're about half an hour in now. For you, I suppose, just on a personal note, obviously, you're in such a fascinating field, but how do you kind of set your own goals now moving forward? Like, what is it that keeps you motivated and, how do you align your kind of ambition with, the trajectory of your career? Like, is it something you think about or is it more just, you want to work on stuff that you enjoy? How do you kind of approach that? Or how are you going to approach that moving forward?
Well, that's a great question, and I believe it's a question anybody who is at the beginning of their career. Relatively speaking, I'm still at the beginning of my business career. It's something that they are thinking about, and something that a topic that, that makes them wonder. I'm afraid I don't have a good answer. Mm-hmm. But we can perhaps talk about some of the things I believe are important. So given my background, of course, I love to learn, and I love to spend my energy and, most importantly, my time, which is clearly the most important resource that we have as a human being, doing things that I think are worthwhile. In the sense that, and let me tell you what's the meaning of work here. It's probably something that is going to have an impact on other people's life. I can start thinking about my colleagues, of course, and my business and my firm. And then, you know, depending on how ambitious you are, you really have to set everybody, you know, on a personal level, has to set the limit to that. That's really important. Especially, perhaps, given, again, my background, I think that the best way for me to make a difference is by using some of the skills and the tools that I've learned. So I think that a good way of doing this is using the tools that tech industry give us, so just machine learning, programming, big data, and so on and so forth. Motivation is key. As I mentioned, the key aspect for being successful and impactful and to really get something done with our time and capability is focus. It's focus. How much, given 1 hour that you spend in front of the computer, how much you can squeeze out of it, and that's really, I think, not an issue, but something that it's key in, especially in the private sector, and while having a job, right? For me, the motivation, and probably for people with my similar background, learning is very important. Knowing that I have that I'm in an environment, and I have, you know, people above me and stakeholders that are aligned with me in thinking that the more I learn and the more my team learns, the more my team is up to date with cutting edge tools, the more we can extract value and give from what we're doing and give value back to, again, our stakeholders. I guess that it's not easy for me.
Yeah, of course.
This question is really a big question.
It's a loaded question, definitely. Yeah.
I think I laid down some topics on the table, and hopefully, you know, somebody, this will be useful for somebody.
Awesome. Massey, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time. It was really interesting. So thank you.
Well, it was my pleasure to, you know, participate to this podcast, and thank you very much for inviting me.
Thanks for listening to the show. I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on this episode over on the Venturi's Voice Slack group. See you next time. Thank you.